Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.
Excitement here in New Zealand has been ignited for this tournament.
Hearing our fans being behind us is just unforgettable.
World football at the Women's World Cup from the BBC World Service.
We're going all the way, baby.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 2nd of August, these are our main stories. The former US President Donald Trump has been indicted on 4 more criminal charges, including conspiracy and witness tampering, when he attempted to cling on to power after losing the 2020 election. The first French flight evacuating European citizens from Niger following last week's coup has departed, and Uber has posted a quarterly profit for the first time since it began operating. Also in this podcast...
Voyager 2 has been exploring space since 1977. It's almost 20 billion kilometres from Earth.
NASA is relieved to have received a signal from the distant spacecraft after it lost contact by accidentally sending it the wrong way. We begin in the United States, where on Tuesday, the former President Donald Trump was indicted on 4 counts by a federal grand jury in Special Counsel Jack Smith's investigation into the January 6th attack on the Capitol and the efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The charges are conspiracy to defraud the US, witness tampering, and conspiracy against the rights of citizens. Mr. Smith made this statement.
The attack on our nation's capital was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy. As described in the indictment, it was fueled by lies. Lies by the defendant targeted at obstructing a bedrock function of the U.S. government, the nation's process of collecting, counting, and certifying the results of the presidential election. In this case, my office will seek a speedy trial so that our evidence can be tested in court and judged by a jury of citizens.
Well, before Jack Smith addressed the reporters, I spoke to our Washington correspondent, Sean Dilley, about this third criminal case against Mr. Trump.
What is interesting is there are no direct charges related to the actual violence per se, at least nothing on insurrection or incitement as far as the violence on the 6th of January, because, of course, intent was always going to be hard to prove that. The charges relate to the period of time from the election onwards. Basically, there are 6 co-conspirators who are not named beyond conspirator 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6. 4 of those are attorneys. And the allegation in chief is that Donald Trump and others worked together essentially to interfere with the election, to disrupt that peaceful transfer of power and to speak to legislature around the United States to persuade them not to confirm, not to certify the results that people had voted towards changing what they call slates. So that, if you like, that's a summary of how people voted from Joe Biden, who rightly won the election, to Donald Trump. The indictment makes for interesting reading. Just thumbing through it, it goes through all sorts of detail in terms of how conversations were had with lawmakers, where it was suggested that there were not necessarily evidence for the claims, but a lot of theories.
With regards to the next steps for Donald Trump, what's coming up?
Well, in the very immediate future, this Thursday, he's required to appear in court in Washington, D.C. to face these 4 counts in relation to the election and the claims that he attempted to overthrow them. It's not the only case he's got going on, of course, and they shouldn't be confused. So, for instance, we might have seen coverage on the BBC fairly recently and beyond about another case in Florida. It's also a federal case. And Jack Smith, who's the prosecutor in that case separately is the case that relates to documents, classified documents that it's alleged he shouldn't have held onto. A court date for a trial has already been set for Florida for May next year. That's separate again to other charges in New York State, where it's claimed, again, quite separately to these cases, that Mr. Trump had been involved in accountancy practices in and around the way hush money was paid to a former adult actress, Stormy Daniels. So he's got quite the calendar of court cases coming up. He has, again, called Jack Smith, the prosecutor, is an independent prosecutor for the US government. He's called him deranged. And again, he's pointing to claims he's made previously that the timing of these charges are more related to stopping him being president than anything to do with justice.
Sean Dilley speaking to me from Washington. As we record this podcast, the first of three French planes sent to evacuate European citizens from Niger following last week's military coup has taken off from the capital Niamey. The French Foreign Ministry organised the flights after demonstrators attacked the French embassy on Sunday. However, France says it has no plans to repatriate an estimated 1,000 French soldiers stationed there. They're part of a multinational team that's been countering Islamist militants. The generals who seized power have accused France of planning to intervene to reinstate the elected president, but Paris denies this. Rebecca Kesby spoke to the French MP, Natalia Pouzyreff, a member of Emmanuel Macron's Renaissance Party, and is also on the National Defence and Armed Forces Committee in the National Assembly. So, what is the scale of the evacuation?
There are like hundreds of French nationals that live in Niamey, because the airspace is closed. I think there may be no other options than to evacuate them.
Niger got independence in 1960. Since then, there's been a very close political relationship, a very strong economic relationship over those years. But in the past year or so, we've seen increasing hostility against French assets in the country. What's gone wrong diplomatically?
Well, I would say that so far the partnership was going well. Of course, there has been French bashing in the area, but this is beyond French bashing. This coup d'etat is, maybe instrumental. Utilizing the image that France has in the region, but we can assume that the reasons behind the coup are because the president Bazoum has dismissed one of the key leaders of the Niger armed force.
Meanwhile, Germany, Italy and Spain have also taken steps to evacuate their citizens from the country. Our security correspondent Frank Garder told us more about the situation in Niger.
It's pretty dire, not just for Western forces, but for Niger as a whole. Now, I know there's plenty of people in Niger who didn't welcome the presence of Western forces, who said that they weren't doing enough to combat the jihadist insurgencies in the region, like Boko Haram. But Niger has been getting hundreds of millions of euros in aid, financial assistance and military training every year from the EU, from the Americans, from the French. All of that is now drying up. Now, almost certainly, I would be amazed if it doesn't happen, Russia will step in. So this is the third domino after Mali and Burkina Faso in the Sahel belt, along with Central African Republic, where Wagner will become the dominant security force. And I think this, let's try and be open-minded about it. Maybe Russia will put lots of aid in. Maybe they will be able to defeat the insurgents. But right now, this is looking pretty bad. And there are no easy options. And I think it would be wrong to think that this is the West versus the junta in Niamey, because the whole of ECOWAS, or almost the whole of ECOWAS, that's the Economic Community of West African States, are against this putsch, are against this coup. They've called on them to reverse it, to restore. After all, the elected president, he was democratically elected, whatever his faults. And these bunch that have taken over, General Tchiani and others, they were not democratically elected. This is a coup. It's undemocratic. And it will almost certainly, as I say, usher in the Wagner Group, who have a pretty brutal record of suppression in the Sahel countries.
Insight and analysis from Frank Gardner. Hundreds of staff of Russia's Economic Development Ministry spent Tuesday working from home after a drone struck the skyscraper housing it. It was the second such attack in recent days on the so-called IQ Quarter Tower in central Moscow's business district.
Russia's air defence said the drones flew in direct from Ukraine. Meanwhile, earlier, Russia's defence ministry said it destroyed three Ukrainian sea drones that tried to attack two Russian naval ships in the Black Sea. Ukraine hasn't commented publicly, but one official in Kyiv said more drones, more collapse and more war were coming to Russia. From Kyiv, here's our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse.
Kyiv has warned of the war coming to Russia, and the last days have suggested, on the surface at least, that tide marks have inched closer. The glossy surroundings of Moscow's financial district used to be a place which felt far from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Two drone strikes involving the same skyscraper have changed the day-to-day reality for people like Anastasia.
After the first attack, everyone said it wouldn't hit the same place twice. And today we all woke up and were a bit shocked. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I think I'll move from here.
Ukraine has been blamed for what the Kremlin calls a terrorist attack. It is always hard to say definitively who is behind strikes like these deep inside Russian or Russian-controlled territory in Ukraine. Professor Justin Bronk is from the Royal United Services Institute.
Often there's very little surveillance radar actually looking at the kind of bulk of, in this case, you know, Russia in depth before you get to key areas like Moscow, where, of course, there are additional layers of defence. So for a lot of that flight path, it's actually potentially very difficult to track those UAVs in real time.
What Kyiv has done is war of more attacks to follow because of what it describes as Russia's own actions. There are Russian media reports of an increase in arson attacks on military recruitment centres. Last week, the Kremlin raised the age limit for people to be conscripted and increased the fine for anyone trying to resist conscription. Drones now frequently land on both sides of the border in this conflict. Only with Ukraine, dozens of civilians die every week.
That was James Waterhouse. Well, the Ukraine conflict seems to have taken the world into a new era of drone warfare, with both sides now using them. Evan Davis spoke to Francisco Serramatins, who runs One Way Aerospace, which builds and supplies drones to Ukraine.
We work with two ministries providing short-range kamikaze drones, which we call scalpels. So these are used by infantrymen to engage enemy armor, enemy infantry. And we're also developing a long-range kamikaze solution, so it's 750-kilometre range, Kyiv to Moscow range, which can deliver precisely 43 kilograms. So on board it has two artillery rounds. So we're working with local partners to mass-produce the system in Ukraine, and over the next few weeks, hopefully, you'll see it deployed within occupied Ukraine and elsewhere as well.
Right. So just to be clear, in Ukraine, you were building drones that could be launched in Kyiv and could strike Moscow.
Correct. You could deploy from within Ukraine and hit anywhere basically up to Moscow and beyond.
And one of those longer range drones, just describe it to me. How big is this thing we're talking about?
So it's 2.3 meters with all the electronics on board, which enable to fly under jamming. It's a very, quite a cheap platform. It's about $24,000, $25,000. So it means we can produce en masse, scale quite quickly, an affordable kinetic strike drone that can hit pretty much anywhere within occupied Ukraine, but also into strategic sites within Russia as well.
And the MOD, the Ministry of Defense in Kyiv, the Ukrainian defense, is a client of yours, a customer of yours. Are they buying them now, or is this something you will be doing and will be providing in future?
We don't comment directly on end users, but basically there's a process of tests that has to be conducted, which also includes a kinetic testing. So until that's conducted, then the procurement will be complete. But we haven't completed that entire process yet. But we should have in the next few weeks, I imagine.
Francisco, are you a regulated business in some way? I mean, can you just sell your drones, which obviously can be quite a weapon? You can't just sell them to anyone.
No. I mean, so UK export licensing only limits for things that are sensitive in nature, so like nuclear weapons, satellites and so forth. So technically, you could sell these systems to other countries relatively flexibly. But from Ukraine, it's rather difficult because it's a time of war and these are considered a defense article by Ukrainian standards. But by UK standards, it doesn't cross the threshold as a weapon because it doesn't actually contain a defense article. But the UK is actually very permissive. So to even get an export license, it's only a few weeks. It's actually quite easy.
Francisco Serramatins from the One Way Aerospace Company. Since the mass protests in Iran last year, hundreds of young, injured protesters have fled the country in the hope of treatment somewhere else. 3 months ago, Sima, with her three-year-old daughter, escaped Iran and found refuge in Iraqi Kurdistan. But Iraqi doctors say they're not equipped to deal with her injuries. They say she needs to go on to a country with advanced medical facilities and have warned that if infection in Sima's arm continues, it might have to be amputated.
The BBC's Jiyar Gol met Sima in Iraqi Kurdistan.
A mountainous terrain lies between Iran and Iraqi Kurdistan. A route riddled with landmines and patrolled by Iranian forces who don't hesitate to shoot. I am driving from Sulaymaniyah, a major Kurdish city in northern Iraq, to a village near the Iranian border.
In the past few months, tens of young, injured Iranian protesters have crossed the border on foot, and they have come to Iraqi Kurdistan to deal with their wounds.
Sima Murad Begi, 26, is one of the injured protesters recently, under the cover of darkness, fled Iran with her daughter and found refuge in Iraqi Kurdistan.
For 3 grueling hours, we walked through a heavy rain and thick mud. I was forced to give my daughter a sleeping pill for the journey, ensuring a noiseless trip.
In mid-September last year, Mahsa Jina Amini, a 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman, was detained in Tehran for allegedly violating strict Islamic dress code. Her death in police custody sparked mass protests in Iran.
Despite numerous arrests, injuries and deaths, people didn't retreat. We were hopeful.
Nine months ago, in the Kurdish city of Bukhan in northwest of Iran, Iranian security forces fired 300 birdshot pellets at Sima, causing severe injuries.
Losing a significant amount of blood, I felt myself fainting. At that moment, my daughter was a thing on my mind.
Sima was rushed to the city's hospital, where the police and intelligence agents were lurking.
I could hear nurses shouting, "She needs a blood transfusion." Amidst the urgency, an Islamic Revolutionary Guard shouted, "Throw her out of the hospital." I could hear everything. I struggled to say, "Don't let me die." Yet I couldn't talk.
Taking Sima to a private hospital in another city, her family remained anxious, fearing the regime agents might arrest her on her hospital bed. To safeguard Sima, the doctor recorded her injuries as a car accident.
I could only sleep 2 or 3 hours a night, with my dreams transferred into a relentless nightmare haunted by the sound of gunshots.
Sima shows me an x-ray of her hand. Around 200 white dots could be seen. They are birdshot pellets remained in her hand. Sima has multiple open fractures with her elbow, bearing severe damage. The pellets caused significant tissue destruction. Despite Sima's physical and psychological wounds, defiantly she says she would protest against the Islamic regime all over again.
I was warned for the sake of my daughter I shouldn't protest. I always replied I protest for the better future for my daughter.
Iraqi Kurdistan doctors say Sima needs immediate care in a country with advanced medical facilities. They were worried if her infection continues, they have to amputate her arm.
That report by Jiyar Gol in Iraqi Kurdistan. Still to come.
We know that exposure to high altitude could have some effects. For instance, headaches, increase in your heart rate and your blood pressure, some nausea.
So how do millions of people around the world acclimatize to working at high altitude? Find out later.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I am the host of a new daily podcast, What in the World, from the BBC World Service, where we try to help you make sense of the world around you, explaining the big events and some of the smaller events, so that you might feel a little bit better when you pick up your phone and scroll through your newsfeed. Just search for What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
You're listening to the Global News podcast, and this year there's been a growing number of migrants crossing the perilous Darien Gap between Panama and Colombia. A record 250,000 people undertook the journey through the jungle where South America meets Central America. This is despite recent efforts by regional governments and the US to curb the flow of migrants. Our Latin America regional editor Mimi Swaby told me more about the Darien Gap.
This is one of the most dangerous passages for migration in the world. It's about 106 kilometres long through really dense, unroaded, thick jungle. And this is a minefield for dangerous snakes and other predators, slippery rocks, erratic riverbeds, which are really challenging to navigate for adults, let alone children who are increasingly making up the number of these individuals passing through. Currently about 20% are thought to be minors and half of those are under five. So those are the natural elements which cause a lot of danger. But then you've also got gangs and other armed groups who occupy a lot of this area who are making millions off individuals through trafficking and smuggling methods, making their way from South and Central America, trying to get up to that US-Mexico border.
Considering the physical, the natural and the human hazards, why has the number of migrants increased this year?
There are as many reasons as there are migrants. Everybody has their own individual reason. But the majority of these migrants are coming from Venezuela, Haiti and Ecuador. And for example, in Haiti, there is a humanitarian crisis, a security crisis and a political vacuum. So it's a real push factor to try and leave the country. And thousands are trying to flee. And there's a similar story in Venezuela where political turmoil is leaving many under the poverty line, really struggling economically. So there are lots of push factors, but then also a lot of confusion about migration policies. Earlier in the year, in April, Title 42 ended, and that was an emergency measure brought in by former US President Donald Trump to basically allow the immediate removal of migrants, no questions asked, due to the pandemic starting, so cited under health reasons. So when that came to an end, a lot of people were given misinformation about if they could come, if they were allowed to be in the country. There's a lot of confusion. So human traffickers, smugglers, really capitalised on that confusion, allowing people to believe with often lots of fake, false hope that they would be able to get to the US, perhaps through the Darien Gap, and make a life for themselves there.
The voice there of Mimi Swaby. The United Arab Emirates is reportedly offering to treble the salaries of Israeli doctors if they move to the Gulf state. It follows a one-day strike by Israeli doctors over the passing of contentious legal reforms in Israel, which many believe will damage democracy. Here's Mike Thompson.
More than 3,000 of them are said to have joined a social media chat group seeking advice on relocating abroad. Many have voiced deep concerns about a law passed last week that limits the power of the Supreme Court to challenge government decisions. In addition to tripling the doctors' salaries, the UAE is also reported to be offering so-called golden visas, allowing them long-term residency. The Emirates normalised relations with Israel 3 years ago.
Mike Thompson there. The popular ride-hailing app Uber has posted its first ever quarterly operating profit since launching back in 2009. It attributed the surprise result to strong growth in its core mobility and delivery businesses. Michelle Fleury reports from New York.
This marks a significant milestone for Uber, which has spent heavily to grow its business over the 14 years since it was founded. The ride-hailing company reported its first ever operating profit of $326 million, a far cry from the $713 million loss a year earlier. It also generated $1.1 billion in free cash flow during the last 3 months. The results show that despite high inflation in many countries where it operates, customers are still willing to pay for the convenience of hailing a ride and getting food delivered to their door. The number of trips taken hit an all-time high.
Michelle Fleury. Around the world, from Tibet to the Andes to the Ethiopian highlands, millions of people work at high altitude. It used to be the case that most people who worked in the mountains were from there. They lived and worked close to where they were born. But in this modern globalised world of mass migration, more and more people are working in environments that their bodies are not accustomed to. The BBC's Gideon Long has been asking what that means for their health.
Buenos días, mi nombre es Leonardo Espos.
Good morning. My name is Leonardo Espos. I've been working at Escondida for 10 years.
Caroline Abayay.
I'm Caroline Abayay, and I've been at Escondida for 16 years.
Those are just two of the workers at Escondida, the largest copper mine in the world. It's in Chile, and it's at 3,100 metres above sea level in the Andes Mountains. That's over 10,000 feet up. To give you an idea, that's higher than the highest peak in Germany, it's higher than Mount Olympus in Greece, and higher than anywhere in mainland Australia. Leonardo and Caroline are among 150 million people worldwide who work at high altitude, generally defined by medics as 2,500 metres or above. I've been talking to doctors about what all this means for workers and the companies that employ them.
My name is Jacqueline Pichler. I'm from Switzerland, working as a pulmonologist for now several years.
My name is Alberto Pacheco. I am the head of health for Minerals America at BHP.
BHP, the company that Alberto works for, owns and operates the Escondida mine.
We know that exposure to high altitude could have some effects. For instance, the high altitude mountain sickness, when you have headaches, increase in your heart rate and your blood pressure, some nausea, problems to have a good sleep. And it will depend on what level of altitude are you exposed to.
The main challenge for the body is the reduced oxygen availability. The heart rate is increasing. So people who work at altitude, they have a reduced performance, and especially where they have to work hard, like physically hard, this is very limiting.
At Escondida, Alberto Pacheco and BHP are responsible for thousands of employees. So what should these workers do once they finish their shifts? Come back down to the lowlands to get some oxygen-rich air, or stay where they are?
The vast majority is the 7x7 shifts, so 7 days at the mine, 7 days off.
Right. Is that because that has been established and recognised as best practice, rather than going up and down every day?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. If you are 7 days at altitude, you have a level of acclimatation to altitude. And if you are 7 days at lower altitude, you don't lose your acclimatation.
It is possible to live and work healthily at high altitude, but you do have to make a bit more effort. Here are Leonardo and Caroline, those two workers at Escondida.
Working at around 3,000 metres has been a good experience for me. In all the years I've been working here, I've never had any problems with the altitude. But that also depends on each person looking after themselves when they're not working, taking care with food, with exercise. It is essential to stay in good shape at this altitude.
Es primordial para poder mantenerse de buena manera a esta altura.
Mi experiencia ha sido muy buena trabajando en altura.
My experience of working at altitude has been really good. I don't have any problems with it. My way of taking care of myself is by sleeping well, being careful with my food, and doing exercise at the weekend. When I'm not at the mine, I also eat well, I sleep well, I do things to relax, including doing exercise.
For companies operating at altitude, it must be incredibly expensive to look after their staff. All those medical checks, doctors, nurses, on-site ambulances, specially designed bedrooms so people can sleep at night. I asked BHP's Alberto Pacheco about the cost.
Well, obviously it's not cheap, but really the most important asset is the people. So if we have to spend money, we will spend.
That report by Gideon Long. Now a message from Mission Control.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
An excerpt there of the song Space Oddity by David Bowie. The danger of a spacecraft losing contact with planet Earth has long been established in our interstellar consciousness. Something goes wrong and an astronaut floats off into the void. Well, nothing so drastic this time. But after sending the wrong command, NASA lost contact with Voyager 2, raising fears of trouble. Now, though, the craft has signalled that it's in good health. Terry Egan reports. Voyager 2 has been exploring space since 1977, making it nearly 46 years into its mission. Laden with science instruments and hurtling at more than 55,000 kilometers per hour through the stars, it's almost 20 billion kilometers from Earth. At that distance, 18 hours are needed for any signal to reach us. But last month, the craft was sent a mistaken command, and it tilted its antenna to point 2 degrees away from Earth. As a result, the probe stopped sending data, data that should make its way to an array of giant radio antenna spread out across the world. Voyager 2 is the only craft ever to fly by Neptune and Uranus. Like its twin, Voyager 1, it carries a golden record with Earth's sounds, pictures, and messages to tell our story in case it's found by extraterrestrials. On Tuesday, officials said they had detected what they called a heartbeat signal from Voyager 2, so they know it's still in operation. They will continue to bombard the vicinity of Voyager 2 with the correct command, hoping to reposition the antenna. If all else fails, the craft is programmed to reset its orientation multiple times each year in order to keep its antenna pointing at Earth, and the next reset is due on October the 15th. In the meantime, the probe is expected to remain on its planned trajectory through the universe. That report by Terry Egan here, back down on Earth. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast a little later on. If you want to comment on this one or any of the topics covered in it, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor, as always, Cara Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow, and until next time, goodbye.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my God, I'm so happy for him. Thank you so much.
That's the sound of Daniela getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be giving her best friend a new gaming PC. And we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you too with a great deal on a reliable award-winning Honda, like the 2023 Accord. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.